Welcome to the Weekly Radio Spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Diane Farsetta.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. In our top spin, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Ron Suskind has unearthed more examples of Iraq War propaganda. In his new book, The Way of the World, Suskind writes that in late 2003, the White House ordered the CIA to forge a letter, supposedly from the head of the Iraqi intelligence agency, to Saddam Hussein. The letter was dated July 2001 and claimed that Mohammed Atta, who led the September 11th terrorist attacks, had trained in Iraq. The Bush administration wanted to use the forged letter to link Iraq to al-Qaeda and 9/11. In December 2003, news media reported on the letter as if it were genuine. Suskind also writes that Iraq's former intelligence chief had disclosed to Western governments prior to the U.S. invasion that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction. The U.S. responded by secretly resettling the Iraqi official in Jordan and paying him $5 million. The White House denies the allegations and has accused Suskind of gutter journalism.
In May, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, carried out a raid on a meatpacking plant in Postville, Iowa, that was widely condemned as inhumane. The agency split up families, charged more than 300 people with criminal offenses, and detained some in animal pens prior to deportation. Now, ICE is trying what it calls a, quote, compassionately conceived enforcement initiative, end quote. For a few weeks, ICE is allowing undocumented immigrants in five U.S. cities to deport themselves as part of its Operation Scheduled Departure. One immigrant rights activist said the program makes no sense and is simply a PR move to, quote, put a happy face on what have been really brutal actions, end quote.
A controversial film questioning global warming was unfair and biased, but not harmful, according to the British media regulator Ofcom. The Great Global Warming Swindle was commissioned and aired by Britain's Channel 4. Following the broadcast, more than 250 people complained to Ofcom, including a detailed filing from scientists. Here's a clip from the film.
But in this film, it will be shown that there is nothing unusual about the current temperature, that the Earth's climate is always changing, and that the scientific evidence does not support the notion that climate is driven by carbon dioxide, man-made or otherwise. Everywhere you are told that man-made climate change is proved beyond doubt. But you are being told lies.
Ofcom faulted the film for misrepresenting statements by scientists and being unfair to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. But the agency said that its impartiality rules did not apply. Because global warming is so widely accepted, it can no longer be considered a controversial issue.
You might remember the Lincoln Group as the public relations firm that secretly placed U.S. military propaganda in Iraqi newspapers. The firm has won several government contracts since its questionable Iraq work was outed in late 2005. Recently, the Lincoln Group won a six-month contract with the U.S. Army that's worth more than $14 million. The contract is part of the Army's efforts to isolate bomb makers and users from the general population of Afghanistan. The Lincoln Group will develop an anti-bomb information campaign using billboards, radio, television, posters, and newspaper ads. One of its goals is to convince Afghans to report suspicious activities.
And now it's time to play 6 Degrees of Spin and Faken, our look at the connections between media manipulators. Earlier, we mentioned the film The Great Global Warming Swindle. The movie's list of interviewees is a who's who of climate change skeptics. One is Fred Singer, who has a long history of consulting for oil, gas, and tobacco companies. Singer runs the Science and Environmental Policy Project, which has questioned whether secondhand tobacco smoke, asbestos, and pesticides really pose health risks. Singer worked with Philip Morris and the Tobacco Institute in the 1990s to challenge proposed regulations of tobacco smoke. Singer promoted what he called the Top 5 Environmental Myths of 1995, which included tobacco smoke, global warming, and radon gas. The PR firm for British American Tobacco had proposed the list to Singer.
That's this week's edition of the Weekly Radio Spin. For more information, visit the Center for Media and Democracy's website at www.prwatch.org.
And we're back with Indie Media on Air. Mozan Beg is one of nine British Muslims who's been held in extrajudicial detention at Guantanamo Bay. He was released on January 25, 2005, without charge.
He died that night. The people had died there before, and I'd seen that happen. And it's unsurprising that that happened because, in reality, when we know in the name of the deaths of the people who died tragically, wrongfully, on September the 11th, that number was 2,976. At least we know how many died. We do know. We're constantly told about it, especially as a Muslim. You will never ever be made to forget. They will harp on about it until we're gone from this planet. In the same way as July the 7th. We will never be made to forget this. And we, as Tony Blair said, as a Muslim community, have to take the responsibility, carry the responsibility, he said, as a Muslim community for terrorism. He even said to the black community that they have to carry the responsibility for knife crime. So then, of course, we have to ask this question. Who takes the responsibility for the people that have died in Iraq and Afghanistan as after the launch of Operation, bizarrely named Enduring Freedom, because I've always thought that freedom isn't something that you endure. Freedom is firstly something that you cherish from the point that you're born to the point that you die. The things, rather, that you endure are torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. But the question has to be asked. In the name of the deaths of 2,976 people, how many have been killed? The answer is, nobody has a clue, nobody knows, nobody cares, because, here's the pun, nobody counts. How many people died in Afghanistan in the first week alone of Operation Enduring Freedom? I had moved to Afghanistan with my wife and children to work on a project to build schools, as I said. And we had to evacuate under the cruise missiles, under the carpet bomb of daisy cutters. Again, euphemistically named, it sounds so nice, doesn't it? A daisy cutter, it sounds like a lawnmower on a Sunday afternoon. It's not. It's a 1,500-pound TNT bomb, and they drop it in a series, and that's why they call it carpet bombing, because it blanketly destroys our whole area. And do you think it discriminates between women and children and animals and dogs and cats and mice and ants? No, it doesn't. Do you seriously think that this bombing somehow is a justification or a response to what happened on September 11th, when that happened simply in the first week, let alone what's happened in the past 6 years with the invasion of Iraq, that followed directly as a result of something that occurred in Bagram, the place where this man was murdered? The answer is, of course, there is no justification. The answer, of course, is that we are too afraid to say what the reality is. That if the striking of people on September 11th was terrorism, which led to their deaths, and it is in my book, then what do we call what has led to the deaths, either directly or indirectly, under the types of weapons I've described? What do we call that? And why is it that we're so picky and choosy when we use the term terrorism? If you look at the word terrorism, you'll find the first time it entered the history of the English language was from the Terror, from France, the Great Terror. But that introduced democracy to the West, so that's okay. That made it okay. 40,000 people were killed and massacred, including by the guillotine. But that's all right. The new modern definitions of terrorism almost completely remove the idea or the notion that states can be responsible for terrorism. It is only individuals and groups. And that is frightening part. Because accountability just completely goes out the window. Because what you're saying is that governments can do no wrong. And it is only the average ordinary person who has to bear the brunt of government policy and attitude. That is extremely, extremely frightening. And last year, my organization, Cage Prisoners, Human Rights Watch, Reprieve, which is Clive's organization, Amnesty International, and the Center for Constitutional Rights produced a report called Off the Record. And it documented specifically the cases who have disappeared. Not the people who, as I said, have been fortunate enough to make it to Guantanamo, but those people who are off the record, have disappeared, Argentina, Chile, junta style. And that is the sort of situation where we are in, where the law simply does not matter, where clandestine operations have been justified continually in the name of protecting national security. Remember, this operation was launched under the guise or the title of Operation Enduring Freedom. And it's the notion, it's the argument that's given to the rest of the world that this is all about freedom, protecting and defending freedom. So much so that if you go to Guantanamo Bay, you will see a plaque, it's bizarre, outside every camp, whether that camp houses children, and there are children in Guantanamo now, who are now, of course, no longer children because they've been there that long, they've grown up adults. Or whether it's the signature camp x-ray that you've seen with people kneeling down in orange suits with the masks over their faces so that they don't bite through the cable of the aircraft because they're like rabid dogs. Or the earmuffs because they might hear something untoward. Or the blackened out goggles they're made to wear. Or the hoods they're made to look like the extraterrestrials we're told that they are. Or whether it's Camp Echo where I was held, which is maximum security isolation, where you have no contact with any human being other than the guards. Or whether it's the new camps that are state-of-the-art, supermax, electronic prisons that have been built that cost tens of millions of dollars. You see this plaque outside every single camp. It says, on about, to defend freedom. That's the bizarre part, because there's there are two parts of this, of course, that sound completely ridiculous. Where's the honor in removing somebody's freedom without charge or trial? Nobody knows the answer to that question, but if you ask the average American soldier, they'll simply say, we are following orders.
You're listening to Indie Media On Air on KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara. In June 2007, the Palestine Media Collective in Canada produced a newspaper parody of the Vancouver Sun that satirized what they see as the anti-Palestinian bias of the newspaper's owners, the Canwest Media Works Publications, Incorporated. Canwest owns newspapers in 14 major metro areas in Canada, plus 13 television stations, a host of radio stations, and outlets in other countries. After the parody appeared, Canwest launched a lawsuit against those who'd produced and distributed the parody for violation of trademark. Only, at the time, they didn't know who'd done it. So they named well-known activist Mordecai Brimberg and six Jane and John Does. Problem with that was that Mr. Brimberg wasn't involved in the project at all. In this next segment, Jane Williams of Red Eye Co-op Radio in Vancouver interviews Brian Campbell. He's a member of the committee that has been established to defend the two people who have come forward in recent weeks to take full responsibility for the parody newspaper.
Last summer, a group called the Palestine Media Collective produced a parody of the Vancouver Sun. The one-page tabloid sheet used the Vancouver Sun's name and typeface, but there were plenty of clues that it wasn't the usual local paper. The banner at the top of the front page dated the issue as Occupation Day, June 2007. In place of the usually seriously West Coast since 1912 was seriously Zionist since 2001, the first full year of Canwest ownership. The lead article was titled Celebrating 40 Years of Civilizing the West Bank and was written by Pirupaganda. 6 months later, Mordecai Brimberg, a well-known activist for the rights of Palestinians, was charged with producing the parody and committing a commercial violation of trademark. Last week, the Georgia Strait published an article by Gordon Murray and Carol Misevich taking full responsibility for the production of this parody. Brian Campbell is with the Seriously Free Speech Committee set up to defend Mordecai and the right to produce political parody, and he joins me in the studio this morning to talk about this most recent development and to bring us up to date on what's happening with the case. Hello, Brian.
Good morning. Hi.
Now, the article by Gordon Murray and Carol Misevich states that they've also now been named in the writ. Is this why they came forward and took responsibility?
No, in fact, they came forward on June 9th to the committee and said they were going to come forward publicly because of the list of questions that Ken West had produced for Mordecai to answer, and most of those questions involve naming people. And so they didn't want Mordecai put in the position of refusing to name names and being sent to jail or being fined, which is what would have happened because Mordecai had publicly stated he wouldn't name any names. So they came forward in response to a kind of a McCarthyite tactic of the Ken West lawyers.
So I guess once he had refused to name names, then there would be an injunction, would there, or a court order, and then he would
Ken West would conceivably go to the federal court to get an order for Mordecai to answer the questions.
And then he would be in contempt of court.
Or the court might say, you only have to answer certain questions, but yes. And then he would be in contempt of court if he didn't answer.
How did they find out that Ken West had added their names to the writ?
Well, since the writ had been issued to Mordecai already and it was going to be a change of the writ of summons, Mordecai's lawyer was notified. And we then let them know that this was, I let them know that this was the case. And the only change that's been made to the writ has been to add Carol and Gordon's name. Everything else is left the same. So, in fact, they didn't go to the court to get their name added until July 9th. Ken West didn't. And they didn't receive the writ until July 22nd, just last week.
And the original writ had three Janes and three John Does, and they've
yes,
just and taken a couple of those out?
They've just taken one Jane and John off, and then now it's two Janes and two Johns.
Okay.
Yeah.
And have they been served a writ?
Yes, they were served the writ last week on July 22nd.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what will this mean for the suit against Mordecai, that they've now taken responsibility?
Well, first of all, they had no evidence that Mordecai did anything, and now they have people claiming that they produced it and they're solely responsible. So with any kind of conception of justice, Ken West would drop the writ from against Mordecai. But since this is really not a trademark issue but a political vendetta, we'll have to see, but it's doubtful that Ken West will drop the writ. So what that leaves with the committee is to move forward, continuing to defend Mordecai and also defending Carol and Gordon because of their right to produce political parody.
Now, as you said, you've been saying from the outset that it's a politically motivated attack on critics of Israel rather than the concern about trademark violation. What effect does this admission by Carolyn Gordon have on that view?
Well, it sharpens it. It sharpens it to the extent that if the writ against Mordecai isn't dropped, then it's really clear that it's a political vendetta. And the writ against Gordon and Carol is primarily because the parody was against the Ken West position on Israel. So it always comes back to that question of Ken West's commitment to defend Israel and their commitment to biased journalism regarding the Middle East.
To what extent have you been able to get that message, very, very important message, out into the media that this is an attack on critics of Israel and it's an attack, in a sense, on free speech?
Well, this is one of the very interesting things about this case. Ken West has a history of litigation against anybody and everybody that they disagree with, partnerships crumbling, people that have made mistakes like Rafe Mayer in Taiyi, or people that they oppose politically. And so they have really cast a chill in the Canadian media environment. So the long and short of it is, with the exception of Co-op Radio and the Georgia Strait, there's been almost no coverage, a couple of short articles in the business page in the Globe and Mail, and one radio program on Bill Good on CKNW, and various other alternate media have given it coverage, like Working TV. But none of the major media in Canada, the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star, and most shocking of all, CBC, has not covered this one second. The question is, what are they worried about? Why are they scared? Why aren't they giving this very important political question coverage?
Have you been able to get coverage outside of Canada in the U.S.?
There have been announcements on various alternate media sites like ZNet, but no, not really in terms of things like Democracy Now! We haven't gotten coverage, and I think primarily because they don't realize the importance of this issue for the debates they're having in the United States around concentration of media.
It's a huge issue in the United States.
It's a huge issue in the United States, and what we are, Vancouver is the lab for the concentration of media. Here we have the most concentrated media in North America, and CanWest isn't just content with controlling the media. They are opposing people that have alternate political perspectives from which they present. So the case that they brought against Mordecai and Carol and Gordon is because they really oppose their position in opposition to the Israel occupation of Palestine. So yes, this should be a warning and a litmus test for all those people in the United States.
So in a sense, it's not just about media concentration, but it's about the desire to control the message beyond even what your newspaper is prepared to print and not print.
That's right. That's the thing that's very unique about this case, is going beyond the media control, the media you own, to try and control the message overall. They're already framing the debate in Canada, and there have been some research studies that have shown how biased the coverage is by CanWest. But they're not content with that. They're going beyond their own media.
What's the next step in the court case?
Well, we'll have an examination for discovery in September of CanWest. We'll see what comes out of that. CanWest hasn't continued the examination of discovery, which began in June. So again, with lawyers being away for the summer, both our lawyer and now their lawyer in August, the case is more or less in abeyance, but it will reactivate itself with an examination for discovery in September.
And let's just go back to the examination of discovery for in Mordecai's case, because some of the questions there were really quite astounding, and I think you brought some of them in. What were some of the questions that they were asking Mordecai to respond to?
Well, what's shocking about the questions that were being asked is they weren't really around the trademark violation, nor was the writ. The questions were really casting the net among progressives and leftists and supporters of Palestine in Vancouver. So questions were, I want all the documentation relating to the Seriously Free Speech Committee, any minutes, meeting, communications, agendas, attendance, as well as members' lists, their addresses, and contact numbers. Now, the Seriously Free Speech Committee didn't even exist when the parody was produced. We didn't formulate ourselves until the spring of this year. Another question was, provide me with contact information, address, phone numbers, email, or otherwise for the individuals I listed this morning, and CanPalNet, Stop War, ISM. Produce any documentation and correspondence around the program that CanPalNet did at VPL last June.
So this
and
is asking
on and on and on for people that have been involved in things with no evidence at all that they had participated in this parody.
So this is just generally people like the International Solidarity Movement, all those people who are involved in that, they want to know their names.
That's
and
right. That's right. So it really looks like what they're doing is they want to get information for who knows what reason on everybody in Vancouver that's involved in support of Palestine and in opposition to the Israeli occupation. This goes well beyond any trademark court case, and it kind of smacks not just of intimidation, but of spying on the left.
You think it would raise red flags in the United States, which suffered so heavily under McCarthyism. So not only the media ownership issue, but also the naming names and the witch hunt.
That's right. And we're beginning to see examples in the United States of major media going after alternate media when they counter them, when they present alternative things on their websites and on their radio programs. So this, what we're seeing in Vancouver with Ken West, looks like it's a trend that's beginning, and it's in the United States now as well.
What's the next step for the committee now?
Well, we're going to continue trying to get media coverage of this issue, but we're also going to start meeting with individuals and organizations. And we would ask your listeners, any that are interested in having a small meeting in their house to meet with Mordecai or Gordon or Carol or other members of the committee, we would encourage them to do that. We need to get the word out more broadly. Since we can't count on the media, the corporate media, we're going to have to go out through community organizations, individuals, unions, student societies, that kind of thing. So that's how we'll be spending our time.
I've been speaking with Brian Campbell. He's co-chair of the Seriously Free Speech Committee, and you can go to their website, seriouslyfreespeech.com.
That was Jane Williams of Red Eye Co-op Radio in Vancouver, speaking with Brian Campbell about the Palestine Media Co-op. Last summer, they printed a parody of the Vancouver Sun newspaper highlighting its anti-Palestine bias. A year later, they are being sued for trademark violation. For links related to this case, visit the Indy Media On Air program page at kpfk.org. You'll also find links there about Mozan Beg, a former British detainee at Guantanamo Bay. His recent talk in Bristol, England, aired earlier in the show. It was recorded and posted online by the Bristol Broadband Co-op. I'm Bronwyn Malden with the Los Angeles Independent Media Center. If you'd like to comment on this show, drop me a line at radioimc@gmail.com. Please join us again next week and every Monday at 3 p.m. for Indy Media On Air on KPFK. 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.